Well, once again, it's my great pleasure to welcome into the studio Dan Renshaw for the next in the series of stories and discussion about the history of mining in the Willow Creek mining area and Independence Mine, environs, and Hatcher Pass, and maybe more. Welcome, Dan. Last session, we became entranced with some substances, such as arsenic and mercury and cyanide and the rest of that. Right. And but one of the things we had talked about a couple of times were parts of the whole milling process and so on. Where shall we go today?
Mike, I've been even thought over that. I feel like we're kind of beating it to death here. Let me suggest that we leave the milling at this point. You had asked me a question way back at the beginning of all of these sessions, having to do with the Independence Mine State Historic Park. And the question you asked was, is it representative of what happened up there in Hatcher's Pass in the Willow Creek Mining District? And my answer was, if you divide it by two, roughly the division point would be World War One, the period just after World War One, the early 20s.
Okay.
And to answer the question posed, it really isn't representative of the early phase, but it's very representative of the latter phase.
Okay.
So what I would like to do on the milling, previously we had worked along in the milling, trying to focus on the early period, when everything was so very difficult to get into the district because of poor roads, a long list of reasons, one of which was just the equipment itself was so over-designed. Everything was exceedingly heavy and so on. So I was trying to work on just that, and then I was going to propose that sometime this summer, I would like to have you come up and we can go into the Goldcord Mill.
Yes.
And now it's very representative of the period after that dividing point.
Okay.
And the odd thing about the Goldcord Mill, it's the only one that has survived the vandals and the miscellaneous fires and whatever, the abandonments and so on. The only one that survived in all of Alaska from that period prior to World War II. Very significant then to use it as a museum piece. But what we could do then is walk around on the mill floor and we could talk about the process. It might, you know, without video, it seems kind of silly. But on the other hand, I think it would evoke questions and might flow.
Oh, no, I think you have a marvelous ability to describe places, people, things, and I think just the sound,
the echoes,
both the yeah. echoes and you know, I guess in my own imagination, what I have is dripping water, but the sound of just walking along on whatever surface that is, et
sure.
cetera, et cetera,
sure.
and I think that might help to focus attention on what you're describing, and that's what tends to happen with audio. So,
yeah,
okay, that's a date.
Okay,
a plan.
Let's do that. So, really, let's just leave milling at this point.
Okay.
I feel that we've over the sequence programs, we kept touching on it. I felt like it was unfinished, but let's leave it that way then.
Let's do.
Okay, and. You probably thought that we were done with Archangel Valley. However,
there's more. We talked about the road, but the valley,
yeah,
not so much.
We were there recently. Let's go back.
Okay, let's
go back
that.
To the Archangel. I have to pull out a few notes here. I normally
that's okay.
Don't have to worry about it, but what I'm wanting is talk a little bit about the Fern Mine. When you go up the Archangel Valley, it makes a big sweeping turn to the north, beautiful valley, really. The Archangel is tributary to Reed Creek on the maps, technically. Reed Creek comes out of the valley that you would normally walk up if you were going to access the Reed Lakes.
Okay, yes.
That creek comes out of the Reed Lake Valley system and makes an abrupt left-hand turn south. And just below where the trail system is, the Archangel Creek will flow into it. Archangel then continues on up in its own right, in its own valley, a very picturesque valley. It's low enough that the peaks, especially those peaks on the left-hand side as you're going north, which would be the west side, are very dramatic. The valley being lower, the peaks then higher, you've got that differential that makes them look bigger than life.
And I remember having skied up the Archangel Road all the way to the end. What was interesting about it, in my memory, was the joy of coming down, because it was all the nice swooping downhill.
Right, yeah. No, it's a nice hiking area in the summer, and certainly skiing, as you point out. As you get up to the, what do you call it, kind of a terminus in the valley, you have a basin that is abruptly higher, and it's called Fair Angel Creek.
Oh, okay.
And Fair Angel then takes off, makes a left-hand turn up into a basin that there are several lakes up there. It's very, very alpine, picturesque. The Archangel Creek proper makes a turn to the right, and it enters a rather broadened valley that has a lot of rise on the valley floor. Leading up to, there used to be a glacier at the terminus of it. Haven't been there in so long, I'm sure it's gone now. There was a cabin up there called the Lane Hut. Lane himself did some mining in the area. But there's, as you progress around that corner, you come to the Fern Mine. Now, the Fern Mine was quite significant in the early days. The first claims that were staked that I can find any reference to, and no names attached to the documents that I've been able to look at. In 1909, for the first staking of claims in the area, showing of interest that prospectors had found something significant enough to stake claims. That was the first. There was a series of claims staked in the area, and eventually those were put together. And in 1919, a gentleman, last name Drumheller, and he's from Eastern Washington, and he's a mining person, and he comes in and puts together all of those claims.
Okay.
And the name Fern, as a mining operation, starts showing up then. Drumheller did a little bit of mining and a little bit of milling, but not significant. The property was kind of in that fallow time period after World War I, where not much happened in the Willow Creek mining district. There was a lot of complications with inflation related to the war effort, a booming economy outside. There wasn't a lot of significance placed on gold. Gold price at $20.
So yep, right.
Things were slow. 1931, a fella comes by the name of McDougall, and he puts the Fern Mine on the map, and he starts producing, and in the next 10 years, he produces over 30,000 ounces, which in today's dollars would be over $30 million worth of output, which makes it significant. Yeah. He does that over a 10-year period, but with a relatively small operation. 41 is our involvement in World War II, so everything comes to a crashing halt. The next person that has anything to do with that property is a guy by the name of Albert Dodson. And this is an interesting name because L. Dodson, not real sure where he came from. Some documents indicate out of Idaho. He had some mining background. He went to work for the Barthoffs at the their early development of the bullion mine. And he really quickly learned all about the mining techniques necessary to mine the type of veins that are found in the Willow Creek District. He then was recommended to the Independence people when they came in the middle 30s and wanted to the Alaska Pacific Consolidated Mining Company that had a lease option on Skyscraper Mountain and Granite Mountain.
Okay.
And they were throwing the dice to see if they could make a mine out of what had never quite made a mine before in the Independence area. They hired Al Dodson to run their operation, and it was the right guy at the right time doing knowing how to do the right thing that made the Independence mine. He was the significant factor. He was so convinced at what he saw was going to make a mine that Al had a house in Seattle. And he went down there and mortgaged his house and took the funds and invested it in this operation.
Oh, okay.
During the winter of 36-37, then, they worked all winter on driving what was called a 900 level. But this is, I'm going to stop there on the Independence. I'm just trying to give you a thumbnail of Dodson, Hal Dodson. Later, Dodson and the management of the Independence mine have a falling out. And so he leaves and does other things. After the war, he shows up at the Fern Mine. And he mines semi-successfully from 1945 until 1950. And 1950 comes. He's got the bins at the mill are full of ore. He's got a mill run he's going to do, but he has one little task he wants to do before he does the mill run. He's quite a hunter, and it's moose hunting time. So he drives over Hatcher's Pass to the west, goes down to the below the tree line for a favorite spot, goes out, shoots a moose, and has a heart attack, and he dies.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, sad story. Sad story. There's a lot of confusion exactly when the next step. Here's a mill ready to full of ore, ready to run. And, of course, there's legal complications, to say the least.
Sure.
And everything got protracted to the point where it was getting very, very late and very cold. And the people who wanted to do that mill run because they needed to have the money themselves, had been working. Waiting for that payday. So finally, they've got heaters, kerosene heaters, and whatever heater they could find scattered all over the mill to keep it from freezing. And they're trying to get everything up and running so that they can have their mill run. Once they get the generator running, they can keep things warm enough. They should be able to get this mill run, probably several hundred tons of and good ore. I remember it was quite good ore. I remember because what happened next was a fire.
Oh.
One of the heaters tipped over. The fluid spilled out on the floor, erupted in a huge blaze, and nobody was attending. And the next thing I know, the whole mill is engulfed. And there's a big hurry to try to place some dynamite charges at the top of the mill where there's a snow shed that leads toward the adit, the portal, and where there's other buildings. And they knew the flames would follow that and burn everything down. So there was this urgency to blow the snow shed down. Well, in the process of that, the guy that's doing the work, and I don't have a name. I think I know the name, but I don't want to use
okay.
the wrong names.
All right.
the guy that's leading this operation, he has this small group of miners that are waiting for their payday too. Something goes terribly wrong, and their stick of dynamite goes off right next to this lead man and knocks him down. It doesn't kill him, but it injures him rather severely. The building is blowing down, and the fire burns the fern mill into nothing but a few ashes, but they save the other buildings. But I'm going to keep calling him Chuck. I think his name was Chuck Biney. And Chuck then didn't understand what had happened to him, and the whole story was so sad. I come across this as a young kid because the next thing he did when the stunned moment passed, he was several days recovering, was to come over and visit my father with plea. The snow hadn't fallen sufficiently to block the roads yet. And so he wanted that ore, which is still in the bins and so on, he wanted to haul it over to the Gold Cord mill and mill it. And my father really wanted to help the guy, but it was an impossible task. Halfway through, the roads would close. Everything would be a disaster scene. He was over pleading with my father. He had his family with him. He had a daughter named Sandra, who that was my age, and we were acquainted. So I remember all of this taking place. Well, that's about the sum total of the story. That ore never got milled. Somehow it disappeared. I don't know where it went. Mm-hmm. And the mine never had another productive day. The mill never got rebuilt. That was the end of the fern mine as we know it. Later, other people, it was patented land, so the ownership of the land continued. Currently, a lady, widow of Fritz Kallenbach, is the owner of those claims. And I don't know of anything that's ever going to happen again at the fern mine.
So in part, what you're saying, the reason why it wasn't followed up was that even though there was quantity of gold there, it wasn't sufficient to overcome the whatever startup cost would be involved in doing it again?
Yeah, we're talking about the 50s, Mike, and we're quickly into the Korean War and all of the escalation of prices, and everything worked against gold mining. It was that way in the 40s, but just double and triple that in the early 50s. It became an impossible task economically. So it kind of sounds like the end of the story. But one day, not long ago, 4 or 5 years, I hear a knock at the door at the Gold Cord mine, and it's this lady, and she looks vaguely familiar, but I can't place her. And she introduces herself as Sandra, the daughter who was my age. Mm-hmm. And she had not been back to Alaska for ever, and she finally wanted to make a trip. She had a couple of friends with her. So I invited them in, and we were talking about the old days. And this incident came up about the stick of dynamite that had gone off right next to her father. Mm-hmm. It was actually her stepfather. And Sandra told me the rest of the story. And it turns out that her stepfather, Chuck, who had one suffering the injury, had just recently married Sandra's mother. Mm-hmm. And she was a widow from one of the miners at the mine that had apparently died in a mine accident. So they were just recently married. And apparently there was a disgruntled suitor in the group of miners who thought that he was the one who should have married Sandra's mother. And he was the one that made sure that stick of dynamite was almost between Chuck's legs right next to him.
Oh.
And so there was more to the story than was ever known to me, and all of this came out so much later.
Sure.
I'm not sure what Sandra's sources were, but she was very definitive about the story.
I'm thinking in my own mind, I've got the imagery associated with going up Archangel Road and ignoring the turnoff to Reed Lakes and continuing on up the road to the Fern Mine. What's the state of the mine today?
Today, it's private property because of its patented nature. I haven't been to the Fern Mine. I've been close here recently, but not actually to the Fern Mine to know what kind of road barricades there are, anything like that. As far as I know, it's just generally open, and nobody's patrolling. Nobody's trying to keep anybody out of the area that I'm aware of.
What about, now, let's going back on down, Reed Lakes, beautiful area.
Yes.
Wonderful. More in the summer because of the boulder hopping you have to do to go up there in any way. But no gold?
The trail steepens at an old cabin that's now completely almost obliterated.
Mm-hmm.
That cabin was part of quite a mining camp at one time called the Snowbird Mine.
Okay.
The Snowbird was a latecomer. There's a group of claims along the south side of the mountain as you walk up the trail toward Reed Lakes. There is a mountain to your left that you're right at the toe of that mountain slope all the way up to where that mm-hmm. old cabin used to be.
Right.
And then when you look up, there's a gap in that mountain, a big cirque area that obviously had been very heavily glaciated. That mountain that you're following on the way up has a bunch of patented mining claims attached to it that are called the Yellowstone. And it follows a vein system. And the Snowbird is part of that vein system, I think. You know, nobody's been able to be definitive on that. But this was all known. The vein was there. Nobody had done any real work on it to try to find any substantial quantity of ore until after World War II. Then suddenly there was a big flurry of activity. A group in Anchorage incorporated and raised enough funds that they moved in a big way. One of the interesting characters of Alaska's mining past is a gentleman by the name of Phil Holdsworth, and they hired Phil to run their operation there. And it was a difficult task for Phil because you never want to create a mining camp, a mill, other infrastructure until you're sure, absolutely okay. sure, you've got the ore to support it underground.
Oh.
And they weren't there yet. But this group kept pushing. We got to get the mill in. We got to, you know. And they didn't have sufficient ore. When they finally started milling, the whole thing just fell apart. It was a tragedy, a misapplication of resources and time and effort. But it was at its peak in the middle, I'd call it the late 40s. There was a bunch of buildings there. There was a large facility housing several generators, and they put the mill up high in that cirque so it'd be close to the mine portal, which turned out to be a terrible mistake. And then they had a transmission line to take the electricity up to run the mill. The big mistake part of it was they were in a snowslide area that they couldn't contend with, and it just drove them nuts. They did all kinds of defensive revetments to try to deflect and stop, and snowslides, just you have fun with that.
Okay.
So
now, just going back a moment to the generators, they burned oil?
Yes, they were diesel.
Diesel oil.
Now, okay. The road at that time was very good. All the way to that point, there was a well-established, it was one of these that later became known as an omnibus road. Every road in Alaska that the federal government touched in any way, spent any money on, was put on a list. And that list was called the omnibus list. And that then was given to the state of Alaska at statehood. This was the federal relinquishment of these old, if they hadn't done any work on it, it became an RS-2477, which is another category of access that we better not touch.
But okay.
Anything they had touched, why, it was a recognized road. And the road into up Reed Creek to the Snowbird Mine was an omnibus. It had been improved by the road commission.
Okay.
And a very good road.
Dan, we have told a bit of the rest of the story beyond the road, Archangel Road, Fern Mine, up a little to the Reed Lakes, and we have run out of time.
So quickly.
But fascinating stories. Fascinating stories about a time and an area that is known by a lot of people today because both in the winter and the summer, it's a hiking area, burying area in the fall. Wonderful time. And we'll hear more when we come back next time. I look forward to it. Thank you, Dan Renshaw.
Oh, thank you, Mike.